This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. Cartoons and cartooning have experienced a renaissance in recent years, with graphic novels reaching the status of literature and cartoons telling more diverse stories than ever. But there are diehard fans to comics and cartoons, and that includes VPR's Mitch Wortlieb. This spring on Vermont Edition, he spoke with three Vermont cartoonists about their craft. Here's Mitch.
If you're like me, comic books were a life-changing medium. I knew that Daredevil, the superhero blinded by an accident that left him with super heightened senses so acute he can tell whether a person is lying just by listening to the speed of their heartbeat, was not real. But panel by panel, I faithfully followed his adventures in Hell's Kitchen as if he was. And other comics like Spider-Man and the brilliantly satirical Howard the Duck, Please Do Not Judge Him by the Alpha Movie, were a gateway to reading books without pictures later in life. But there is something about words being joined by drawings that still holds sway. Perhaps it's because comics and cartooning offer a blend of what we love most about movies and books. The narrative power of a clever story or phrase is there, joined by a visual image that doesn't move. But in that stillness, we can pore over the page multiple times, go back and go forward at the speed we choose, and find new subtleties each time we look. Today on the program, we're going to delve into the power and passion of cartoons and comics with three Vermont-based masters of the medium. Joining me in our VPR studios in Colchester is Rachel Lindsay, creator of the comic Rachel Lives Here Now, which you can find in the 7 Days newspaper. Rachel somehow dug into my brain by doing one strip that hilariously tackled a subject I've actually spent time discussing in real life, the difference between Cliff and Luna bars. Rachel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined in the studio by Robert Waldo Brunel Jr., the man behind the comic strip Mr. Brunel Explains It All. And if you want the best and funniest explanation of how climate change actually works, you should do a search of his catalog. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We also have with us from our Norwich studios today Stephen Bissett, a comic book illustrator and teacher at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction, whose work with Alan Moore on the reinvention of the character Swamp Thing in the 1980s should be required reading for every human being on the planet. Stephen Bissett, it is such an honor to have you with us on the program today.
Thank you so much, and I hope every human being does do it. Our royalties will go up.
We'll see what happens. And we hope that you will join the conversation as well. Do you think political cartoons pack more punch than an op-ed in the New York Times? Do you think Zippy the Pinhead holds the secrets to the universe, despite or perhaps because of his love for putting taco sauce on ring dings? Did you grow up reading comic books and then gravitate to the edgier graphic novels that brought characters like Batman into new light or dark, as the case may be? You can send us a message on our VPR Facebook page or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net or just give us a call, 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And Rachel Lindsay, I want to start with you. I'd say that you're fairly new to the cartoon game, except that, you know, I'll wager you've been making drawings and cartoons for a long time now. How did you get started in cartooning?
Well, I mean, I always drew, and I love telling stories, and I love making people laugh. So it's just kind of a natural thing for me to pick up. And then when I was in elementary and middle school, I always tried to kind of do comics instead of papers, and that worked quite well for a while. And then I had a strip in my high school paper that was really similar to Rachel Lives Here Now. It was called Thoughts On, and it was kind of the same slice of life thing. And you know, then I went to college and tried to keep it going.
I mentioned in the intro that you did a strip that gets into the man-woman gender dynamic that's inherent in Cliff and Luna bars. I've puzzled over this myself. I've had to fess up to my wife that I'm reluctant to eat a Luna bar because it seems like it's only for women. Mm-hmm. You actually did a whole comic strip on this, and it was so funny. What was your thought process in creating that very funny strip?
I was a cashier at City Market for quite some time. And of course, you know, when you're standing around for 8 hours ringing up groceries, different thoughts occur in your mind. And so that was one of them, that Cliff and Luna were the power couple of nutrition bars. And the fun part about that was that I sent it to them on Facebook, being a former, you know, marketing slave. I knew some 24-year-old was monitoring their Facebook, and they were like, can we tweet this? Can we send this to the whole company? And got a care package. So that worked out quite well for me. In addition to, you know, speaking to you, I got some Cliff and Luna bars.
It really was so funny. I read that. I said, I can't believe that someone is actually writing about this, because I've spent time thinking about it. Robert Brunel, your strip, Mr. Brunel Explains It All. It's a no holds barred political comic that it actually does what it says. It explains some thorny political issues, but always with sharp wit, very funny observations. What made you gravitate towards wanting to do a comic strip, especially because you come from a painting background as well, right?
Yes, I'm a painter and a kinetic sculptor and a book illustrator. And for many years, I was an art teacher at the Browns River Middle School for 30 years. So I taught cartooning all those years. And then in 1997, the Burlington Free Press had a contest for political cartoons, amateur political cartoons. And I won it. So I said, maybe I can do something with this. So I began putting cartoons in Vermont Times newspaper. Your older listeners may remember the Vermont Times. And then in 1999, it was picked up by Funny Times, which is a national humor anthology, and then shortly thereafter, Humor Times. So that's where they are today.
Is political cartooning something that you followed in your younger days? Did you read Doonesbury or some of those related comics?
Yes. I'm interested in nearly all forms of cartooning, but because I'm a know-it-all, I figured the political cartooning would be the way to go. The title of the strip comes from the fact that I was an art teacher, so I was Mr. Burnell, and that was my job, to explain it all in the classroom.
Your comic reminds me a little bit of another comic that's being currently made with a political bent, This Modern World by Tom Tomorrow. Certainly your own strip has its own unique style and flair. Is it a fair comparison, though, for people who may be aware of that strip to compare it with yours?
Yes. Tom Tomorrow, I love his stuff. He draws in this retro style. He tries to make the cartoon look like it was made in the 1950s.
Right.
And I wouldn't say that I copy his style, but his sensibility, like him, I kind of lean to the left, even though I try to skewer both sides of the aisle equally.
Yeah, I think people will find that as they tune in. I want to get to that in a little bit, too. I want to turn to Stephen Bissett now. And Stephen, I have to do that, you know, a little bit of that disclaimer thing here. I'm such a huge fan, so I'm going to gush a little bit about this. But, you know, I read your work with Alan Moore on Swamp Thing back in the day. It took a character that it really had been kind of just a creature from the Black Lagoon caricature and introduced themes of environmentalism, featured a strong female protagonist who was every bit as integral to the plot as the Swamp Thing. And I think that was kind of unusual for the 1980s, too. As an illustrator, how did you approach depicting the narratives that Moore introduced, these very serious themes?
Well, bear in mind, when you're doing comics, you're not just an illustrator. That is part of the job, but I'm primarily a storyteller. The approach that we took to Swamp Thing, I was working on the book with John Tottleben, who is a Pennsylvania native. And we were working with a writer named Marty Pasco, and we were told by our editor, Len Wein, who was the co-creator of Swamp Thing, that we'd be working with this new writer from England named Alan Moore that we'd never heard of him. But John and I had. We'd been reading Warrior magazine out of the UK. And Alan's approach to scripting was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. I'd been working in the field professionally since 1977, saw my first Alan Moore script in 83, and Alan's scripts were conversations to the artist. Alan would lay out in the script not only what was going to be required of us for drawing the panels and the pages, but where this was leading, what clues he wanted us to place in the art early in the issue that would be integral to how that story ended. And that ending I'm referring to might be two or three issues later. So Alan was taking an approach as a writer that I hadn't seen before. And I had drawn many scripts by that time and worked with many writers. And it was really liberating. Alan was asking something of us that no other writer had asked of us. And he had also was welcoming us in as collaborators on a level that I also hadn't experienced as yet, unless I was working with, you know, one of my buddies from the Joe Kubert School, where I graduated from in 78, including Vermont cartoonists like Rick Veitch and writers who worked in comics who were from Vermont, like Steve Perry and Tom Veitch. Alan really upped all of our games.
What were some of those things, Stephen, that he asked you to do that you say you'd never been asked to do before?
You know, part of it was I was of a generation that had grown up with underground comics, and that was quite unusual. In fact, the reason I wanted to work in comics was because of the underground comics, comics like Zap and underground comics like Skull and Slow Death. So Alan was tapping that underground tradition as well as mainstream comics, superhero comics, and so on. The other thing is that I'm a movie junkie. You know, I'm as if I could have had access to the kind of video and videography technology that young people have today, I probably would have pursued that instead of comics. And there were filmmakers like Nicholas Roeg, who in the 70s made movies like Performance, Walkabout, Don't Look Now. I wanted to do that in comics. I wanted to have that sophisticated level of storytelling where you're really immersing the reader in a narrative experience that plays on all your senses, not just what you're seeing, but also what you smell, what you taste, and so on. And Alan was a Nicholas Roeg fan as well. And that's part of what we were trying to do in Swamp Thing, was to make a mainstream American comic book work on the same level as a novel by Stephen King, a film by Nicholas Roeg or David Cronenberg, because what was happening in all the other media around us was so exciting. But American comics were still very staid and conservative by compare.
There was such a cinematic quality to that book. There really was. And I think that comes through in your illustrations and much of the narrative that Alan Moore put forth in that. We're going to get back to some of that in a moment. We are talking about comics and cartooning today. We've got three guests with us, Rachel Lindsay, and she does Rachel Lives Here Now. You can find that in 7 days. Robert Brunel is with us. Mr. Brunel explains it all. And Stephen Bissette, the legendary illustrator who now teaches at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 800-639-2211. Rachel, I want to ask about how much of your personal life you include in your comic strips. I'm assuming it's a fair amount, given the title is Rachel Lives Here Now.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the title for that blog was just, which it started out as a webcomic back when I moved to Vermont in 2013, I should say. And, you know, you got to name your website. And I was just trying to get it out there. And I was like, man, what am I going to call this, you know? And so it was just the easiest thing that I could put out there. But, you know, subsequently, people were interpreting it as my state of mind, and kind of it was really interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's personal, but it's not. I mean, I have other projects that are deeply personal that I'm working on, and I try to, you know, a lot of young cartoonists and people that are active doing, you know, the memoir stuff these days really gravitate towards things that are very painful. And I just try to not do that in my work and keep it pretty light. So just approaching things with an active curiosity and keeping it positive.
What were some of the comics that you enjoyed? Maybe some strips that inspired you as you were getting into this?
Oh, man. I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't read that many comics. Definitely Calvin and Hobbes. The common denominator, honestly. And then I read Persepolis when I was in high school, and that just, like, blew my mind. And that was when I was like, whoa, like, a lot can happen with this. Like, and then when I moved to Vermont, I had access to just all of a sudden all of these amazing comics. And, you know, I loved, when I was in college, I loved Black Hole. That was another huge thing. And I got to look at some single issues of that, which was insane. And then I got, you know, really into the alternative comics, like Steve was mentioning, and just kind of recognized that as a really important precursor to the kind of work that I was doing. And more recently, David Mazzucchelli. I really, really love his work.
He did great work on Daredevil back in the day with Frank Miller. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Asterios Polyp, his graphic novel is incredible. I mean, talk about visual storytelling. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Alison Bechdel. I mean, just the perfect example of, like, someone who cares about draftsmanship but also is a good writer, which I feel like has gone by the wayside recently. People who can write words think they can draw pictures. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, sorry, but, you know, there's got to be a balance, and sometimes it's just you could take a little more time, you know.
And make it a little bit, you know, more sophisticated to match your narrative.
It's if you're going to call it visual storytelling, right, tell a story visually.
Robert Brunel, you're a Vermont native.
Yes, I am.
And what about this atmosphere here? You know, Rachel was just talking about Alison Bechdel. We've got Harry Bliss in the States. Stephen Bissette is also a Vermont native. Is there something about Vermont that brings out great cartooning and comic book artists?
Well, not just cartooning. I think art in general. As I tell my painter friends, we probably have more artists per square mile than Manhattan at this point, which means it's a great place to make art, but it's not a great place to sell art because there's just too many of us. Yeah. In fact, this would be a good time to mention the Vermont Comic Creators Group was just formed. We have over 90 cartoonist members, and we're still growing.
No kidding. What is this group about?
It's amateur and professional cartoonists. We get together once a month and chat. Not all 90, but it was founded by Greg Giordano and Mike Wagner. And you can find us on Facebook or on our website, Vermont Comic Creators. And we're hoping to become an organization that can actually put out books and things in the future. We're just in the beginning stages, but.
Well, I think that's another good point. You've got this group now, and I wonder about the perhaps solitary nature of what you do, because, you know, this is, as Rachel was saying, you have to be able to draw as well. And I am really jealous. I love my job, but if I could do anything else other than playing in center field for the Red Sox, it would be to be a cartoonist, really. And you know, I don't have that talent to draw, but you are isolated, are you not, when you do your jobs?
Yes, we are. It's a solitary profession, which is what makes the group so great, because we can get together and swap stories and talk about technique. And
But also we haven't talked in a long time, so we're all just like, blah, blah, blah.
Yes. I've learned a lot, because a lot of the members have had experience in many different types of cartooning, so I just sit there and listen to them tell me stuff.
That's cartoonists Stephen Bissett, Rachel Lindsay, and Robert Brunell speaking with VPR's Mitch Wertlieb this spring. We'll have more on their conversation about the art and culture of cartooning just ahead. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. In May, the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction celebrated its 10th anniversary. In honor of that occasion, we invited three Vermont cartoonists to talk to us about their craft. Robert Waldo Brunell Jr. is the creator of Mr. Brunell Explains It All. Rachel Lindsay created Rachel Lives Here Now, which is published in 7 days. And Stephen Bissett, who's legendary for his work on the saga of the Swamp Thing and Taboo. Bissett now teaches at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction. Here they are talking with VPR's Mitch Wertlieb on Vermont Edition last spring.
And Stephen Bissett, I have a question here from our own VPR producer, Sam Gale Rosen, who is apparently as big a comic book geek as I am. He wants to know if you have any favorite artists that are currently working in the industry. He says the work of J.H. Williams III, another Alan Moore collaborator, reminds him a lot of your style. And he references one of the amazing hallucinogenic love scenes between Swamp Thing and Abby in the episode Rite of Spring, one of my favorites.
Because I teach at a cartooning school, most of my favorite cartoonists are our students and alumni, because that's the work that I'm spending, you know, much of my life with. There's a lot of amazing work being done right now. Michael DeForge is a Canadian cartoonist who's been doing some work that I really love. He was originally being published by Koyama Press out of the Toronto area. I'm revisiting a lot of work by cartoonists like Skip Morrow, who's also a Vermonter. He does single panel gag cartoons, but I love Skip's work. I've also been revisiting a lot of work by Allison Bechdel. Allison lives in Vermont, and I recently pulled together out of my archives my collections of Dykes to Watch Out For. And Allison was doing terrific work, you know, week by week for a lot of the alternative weeklies. Most people now, of course, are aware of Allison's work on Fun Home, but boy, she was really good doing that weekly alternative strip, and she did it for a long time.
Can you give us an idea, Stephen, of what it is like at the Center for Cartoon Studies when you're teaching your students? I mean, it seems to me you're either a capable artist or you're not. Your students probably already have innate ability, but you know, do you try to hone their talents, bring out something that you see in them that they may not see in themselves, or how does it go?
Well, I'll start by trying to disperse some of the myths. I mean, comics isn't just about drawing. Prior to the Vermont Comic Creators Group, there's a group called Trees and Hills, and it was co-founded by a Vermonter, Dan Barlow, who at that time was a reporter by profession. He was a reporter for the Brattleboro Reformer and then the Rutland Herald. Dan loved comics, like you, Mitch, and didn't think he had any business trying to do them. And we were doing a 24-hour comic event at the Brattleboro Museum down in Brattleboro, Vermont. And I convinced Dan to come and try it. And it opened up a whole world. And Dan co-founded with Colin Tedford from New Hampshire another cartoonist collective that was New England-based called the Trees and Hills Group. You know, some of our students come in with impressive drawing chops, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily good storytellers. Writing is a strong component, as Rachel and Robert can attest. And the kind of writing that Rachel would do for her strip Weston the Stoner might be very different from the kind of writing Rachel's going to be doing with Rachel Lives Here Now. Robert has done illustrated books for adults and children. He's collaborating right now with Joseph Citro on a book, Vermont folklorist Joe Citro. You know, you've got to have certain skill sets but that you're refining, and you may think you're a good illustrator or a strong writer, but it's the combination of all those skills that really feeds comics. I often use the metaphor of ballet. You know, you may be able to move your body around, but try ballet.
It's a lot more than that.
Yeah, doing comics is this interdisciplinary media where it's not just your illustrative skills. I can do a decent drawing, and I guess I've been able to for much of my life. But can I tell a story? And can I compose a page? And the challenges that face someone doing strip cartooning, where you're working in the constraints of 3 to 4 panels, is very different from tackling a graphic novel, where you're doing, you know, 120 or more pages. There's compositional skills in doing a page that have a graphic artist component, but you can't lose sight of the writer doing the storytelling as well. And that's part of the reason why a lot of my favorite creators who work in comics are writer artists, people like Frank Miller, who also grew up in Vermont. He went to Union 32 up in East Montpelier. And Rick Veitch, who I mentioned earlier. You know, your ability to hone all your skills are very important. And the kind of writing that Robert does with Mr. Brunel Explains It All is very different from what Rachel's doing and is very different from what I'm doing when I'm, you know, doing a ghost story in comics form or a project like Tyrant, which was about the birth, life, and death of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, where I'm trying to immerse the reader in what it is to be an animal in the real world.
Rachel was just giving me a thumbs up on Tyrant. I think she wants everybody to read that. We're actually going to go to the phones right now. I think you had mentioned Frank Miller, Stephen, and we may have a connection there. Cynthia is on the line from Calais. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, I just had to call. Frank is my brother-in-law, and I want to underscore what your guest just said. Frank, according to his mother, didn't really have as much drawing ability as my husband, but his brother. But you know what? Frank lived Superman and different superheroes when he was little. He'd have his pajamas on underneath his clothes, and my husband Steve would say he'd be out in the woods somewhere, Frank would disappear, and out he would come with his Superman pajamas on. And then, you know, it was the storytelling that that I think really made him famous. And I was sitting next to Neil Adams at the Sin City screening, and Neil was telling me about, you know, he'd send him off. You know, he'd come in. They called him the Mountain Man. He wore his flannel shirt there, and he'd say, go back and draw hands for 6 months, you know, and Frank would. Finally, Frank was dropped off in New York City by his father and my husband, and he was literally a starving artist for a long time, and now he'll be in the history books. So
no question.
I don't have. You probably know a lot more about his work than even I do, but just had to call in.
I really appreciate the call, Cynthia. Thank you so much. Frank Miller, for those who don't know him, kind of changed the game. I mean, the reason you're seeing all these, you know, sort of dark movie depictions now of The Dark Knight, Batman, et cetera, is because Frank Miller took that character of Batman, did some great work with Daredevil too, and took it from kind of the swashbuckling, slapdash, colorful comics into a much darker realm, but with great narrative skill and great, great dark themes that were just brilliantly done.
Frank inspired our generation. Frank doing Daredevil is part of what sparked John Tolleben and I, when the opportunity presented itself to work on Swamp Thing, because we'd seen what Frank had done. We'd been reading his work, and it's like, okay, we want to do that now too. And then later we became friends with Frank. We met him through comic conventions, which was wild because I grew up 15 miles from where Frank went to school. But if you weren't in band or athletics, you weren't going to meet other cartoonists back in the 60s.
I want to throw this question out to the panel, really, because a couple of people want to know about getting involved in the business. Travis emailed us, as a budding comic book artist author with my first book wrapping up in June, can the panelists offer any tips for self-publishing in Vermont? Alternatively, can they offer insights on getting published in Vermont at all? Robert, you want to start?
Yeah, I self-publish all of my cartoon anthologies. Every year I gather the best of that year and do a look back. And I've been using a site called Lulu.com, and I find it very user-friendly, and there's no upfront cost, which is important for us poor starving artists.
And Rachel, how about you? Did you self-publish much of your work before getting picked up by papers?
I mean, it's really expensive. And I mean, it depends what you're going for. I think that it's a medium specific thing. Like if you're doing a graphic novel, it's going to be a different kind of thing. And my comic series, The Wizard of Life, I wanted it to look and feel like a comic book. I didn't want it to be silkscreen. I didn't want it to be photocopied. I wanted it to feel like a book. And so I printed that through RA Comics Direct. It's in California. When that proof came in the mail, I like cried because I had been seeing it on a screen. But I highly recommend them. You just where you got to watch out is where you put the price point, because you want to get exposure, you want people to buy it, you want to keep it low, but you also don't want to get ripped off. So, you know, you just got to be careful about that. But just get it out there.
Just get it out there and keep working, I'm sure. Tim posted this comment on Facebook. He says, in the late 80s, I spent an evening with friends. A Far Side comic book lay on the kitchen counter. I opened it and started reading. Now I was used to receiving comics in single doses via the papers, but reading Far Side comics one after the other had me in hysterics. Sitting on a kitchen stool, I tried to keep breathing, tried to stay upright, tried to talk, tried to show the comic to my friends. Nothing. I was gone. Good memories. And this is kind of interesting. Silas posted that Lunig's Bistro in Burlington, originally co-founded by Laura Thompson and Dennis Morisseau, was named after a famous cartoonist, Michael Lunig. I did not know this. And you're nodding your head there, Robert.
I did know that. I remember reading about that, I think, back in the 80s.
Wow. So, again, the Vermont connections here are just unbelievable. Stephen Bissett, working on Swamp Thing, as you said, you were inspired by Frank Miller. I want your take on what you think of some of the movie adaptations now. I mean, this is such big business for Hollywood. They see nothing but dollar signs. And I have a mixed bag feeling about this myself because I revered those comics, as I'm sure that you did. And I don't think they get it as right as they should. Some of them are better than others. Alan Moore very famously has said he will not even go to see any of the movie adaptations that have been done of his books. What do you think about how Hollywood has tackled this?
You know, there's been some terrific comics that were adapted into film and it fell down as movies. They just don't work as movies. But there's also been some amazing adaptations of comics into film and graphic novels into film that people don't tend to think of off the top of their head because, you know, we're only aware of the coming Avengers movie or Batman versus Superman movie. You know, movies like American Splendor, which was based on Harvey Pekar's autobiographical comic. And Harvey didn't do it alone. He was a writer, not an artist. He had a whole group of artists that worked regularly with him. That was a terrific movie, and it was terrific on multiple levels. It featured, you know, an actor playing Harvey Pekar. It featured Harvey himself and his wife, Joyce Brabner, who were also characters in the film, and animation of Harvey Pekar's cartoon self, based on how artist Gary Dumm had drawn him in the early American Splendors. God, there's some wonderful comic-based films. One of my favorites is a film from 1967 called Diabolik. It was released in America as Danger Diabolik. Hmm. But those are the kind of movies we don't think of. We're only thinking of the big budget, you know, summer blockbusters. The next torrent is starting, I think, this weekend, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, the Civil War thing, yeah.
But there are some – I just saw Diary of a Teenage Girl up at the Savoy Theater late last year, earlier this year. That's based on a graphic novel by Phoebe Gluckner, and that was an incredible movie. But people don't talk about it as a comics movie because they are always thinking of, you know, characters in tights with superheroes fighting apocalyptic menaces. And that's true going all the way back to the silent era. Most people, if you had asked them then about comics movies, they would only think of the comic strip adaptations. There were, one of the first movies made from comics was a ripoff of Happy Hooligan, one of the early American comic strips. My mom would have thought of Little Abner, you know, which had had two movie versions, the second one based on a very successful Broadway production.
And there was a whole series of Blondie movies in the 40s, as I recall.
Yeah. Actually, Robert, one of my trick questions for my students is what comic yielded the most feature films? And it's Blondie. There were over 32 Blondie feature films.
Amazing. What's the one, and maybe the panel here, I'm forgetting it. Maybe it was based on a Chris Ware comic. Was it Ghost?
That's a Dan Clowes.
Dan Clowes, I'm sorry.
Man.
Yes, that's right.
My
Dan
man.
Clowes was great. There was a pretty good film adaptation of that one that was made. Rachel, what about you? Are you a fan of comics being adapted into movies back and forth, or are you more of a purist when it comes to your art form?
Well, I'm glad that Steve mentioned Dan Clowes, and he was another really important influence on me. 8-Ball is the most incredible satirical comic ever. I mean, and it's funny because I just read his new book, Patience, and, you know, which is like, oh, tour de force, da-da-da. But it just doesn't have the same effect. And he does a lot of films now. I think Wilson is being made into a film. And there seems to be this kind of reflexivity between, like, film adaptations of his work and the way he's drawing now, at least in my opinion. If I have the complete 8-Ball, reading the complete 8-Ball and reading Patience is like night and day. Hmm. It's like you're seeing this sort of like film. It just looks like, you know, you might draw a storyboard. There's no, the details in the character's face are not there. He doesn't use the same, you know, diversity of style. And the words, it's just less important. And, you know, that's whatever he's exploring is great. I love him. He's amazing. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder, you know.
Yeah, what's happening with
yeah.
that? You know, it's interesting. You mentioned all these titles. And for people that may want to get into the comic book world, is it easy, Robert, to walk into a comic book store and say, you know, hey, I've heard all these great titles. I don't know where to start. Are you going to get kind of the short shrift there, you know, from, you know, is it too insider baseball?
Well, yes and no. It depends on your genre. I'm kind of the odd man out because I'm a political cartoonist, which is a little different than what these guys are talking about.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I know Earth Prime Comics here in Burlington has been very nice about selling people's work of local creators.
Stephen Bissette, just about a minute left here. I'm going to give the final word to you. What is it about cartooning, about comics, about this visual medium that has made it your life's passion?
Oh, God. It's, you know, it has the fewest filters. Whatever I put down on paper and hand to a person to read or look at, it's a direct current. I don't have this mountain of middlemen or gatekeepers between us. And that's pretty true with published comics as well. You know, what Rachel puts down on paper, what Robert puts down on paper, or on their Wacom tablet if they're working digitally, I am seeing directly what they put down.
That was cartoonists Stephen Bissette, Rachel Lindsay, and Robert Brunell speaking with VPR's Mitch Wertlieb this spring. Stephen Bissette is best known for his work on the saga of the Swamp Thing and Taboo. He now teaches at the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction. Rachel Lindsay is the creator of the comic Rachel Lives Here Now, published in 7 days. And Robert Waldo Brunell is behind the comic strip Mr. Brunell Explains It All. They spoke with us in May as the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction was celebrating its 10th anniversary. Coming up, Rutland's Polish immigrants. The Polish community there was tight-knit for half a century after World War II, and a lot of people say that a local Polish radio program played a big part.
I would hazard to say that everybody in town had the show on at 10 o'clock in the morning.
That story is just ahead on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. Many people in Rutland are debating what impact new refugees would have on the city. But immigrants from Italy, Ireland, and Eastern Europe have already left indelible marks on the Rutland area. In West Rutland, the Polish community has been especially vibrant, and a long-running radio show helped keep the music and culture of that community alive for decades. VPR's Nina Keck has our story.
If you grew up in West Rutland after World War II, chances are you know this voice.
Jak szybko mija chwile, a szybko mija czas. Tak tiež je náš ostatný program Polskej radiovej.
That's the late Joseph Kruschel, better known to his listeners as Uncle Joe.
A good snowy Sunday morning to all of you. The time, 6 minutes past the hour of nine, and it's time for the favorite Sunday morning program, The Polish Hour.
Kruschel was on the air for 45 years, from 1948 to 1993. Every Sunday morning, he played polkas, promoted Bonnie's Beauty Shop, TNT Tractor, and other local businesses, while chatting up listeners in a mix of English and Polish during his hour-long radio show.
Dzień dobry, miłym słuchaczom. Niedziela rano i czas na polski program. A więc zapraszamy wszystkich posłuchać naszego dzisiejszego programu.
There was only one Sunday that my dad missed, and that was for my sister's wedding, which was in Maryland. So there was no way he could not, because he did the show live. He was not going to tape it. He was never going to tape it. There was no such thing, as far as he was concerned, as taping it. He was going to do it live.
That's Mary Nemeth, Joe Kruschel's daughter.
I started helping him at 10 years old in 1965, which is kind of weird. But I would watch him. I would watch him on the radio. I'd watch all the dials, the turntables, and I just learned it. And I wanted to be that DJ when he wasn't there, but he was always there.
In the 1950s and 60s, life was more tranquil. There was a certainty. You know, you knew every Sunday you would be listening to Uncle Joe.
West Rutland native Mary Retzik says growing up Polish in West Rutland, you focused on three things: the Catholic Church, school, and one's family. And she says families and Polish traditions were big back then.
It was all pervasive, the Polish culture. We spoke Polish, and this neighborhood in particular was pretty much all Polish as well.
Mary Nemeth says her grandfathers came to West Rutland from Poland at the turn of the last century. Like many immigrants, they got jobs in the marble industry. Her father's radio show was a side gig. He, too, worked in the marble industry and also handled maintenance for the Polish church and school. She admits that's probably why her dad sounded more like a repairman than a radio host.
And ladies, remember, a prettier you starts with a pretty hairdo. A hairdo from Bonnie's. And right now, we'll take a look at the weather.
Mary Nemeth helped her dad produce the Polish Hour for almost 18 years. She never asked him how it all started, but says back in the 1930s and 40s, he began collecting records and would play them at local dances.
And he just had this love for the Polish music. He didn't dance, never danced, but he had this love for Polish music and people.
After World War II, she says her dad went from DJing Polish dances to playing polkas on the radio, first at WHWB, then at WSYB in Rutland.
He had a theme song. It was the Dream Polka. And then he had like three happy birthday songs, and he played them until the records wore out.
Okay, we're going to continue with good old polka music, and we're going to pick on another old one here right now. The Happy Birthday Polka. This one is done for us by, yes, folks, you remember, Frank Duvall and his orchestra. And we're going to send it out this morning to Lauren Balchuk, who will celebrate her birthday on December the 30th, and it's requested by Babcia.
So the first one was by Frank Duvall and his orchestra, and it was this happy birthday thing. And, you know, if you live to be 103, and today people are living to be 103, and I remember that record wearing out and him saying, I don't know if I want to throw this away, but it wore out. People would send us requests from everywhere. Wherever the radio signal went, they would send us requests, and they would say, this is my son's birthday and my wife's birthday. I want such and such a song. And we had records. We had closets of records. And we used to lug them to the radio station every week.
Here's a happy birthday. May you live to be 103.
Everybody in town knew that it was your birthday because Joe announced it.
In the second half of the 20th century, West Rutland had other immigrant communities, Irish, French, and Swedish. A local Italian radio hour also aired on Sundays. But Mary Retzik says that hour of polka music every week was a cultural touchstone.
I think Uncle Joe's contribution to Polish culture was definitely, you know, significant, immense, because it was something that held the town together, held the Polish culture together.
Joe Kruszel signed off from the Polish Hour for the last time in 1993, 45 years after he started.
I spun many records, and my wish is that I would bring good old Polish music into the hearts of many. Thank you for letting me come into your homes each Sunday morning.
More than 20 years later, memories of his role in West Rutland's Polish community still resonate strongly. Joe Kruszel passed away in 1997. He was 72 years old. For VPR News, I'm Nina Kak.
And we end today on another musical note. Our colleagues at VPR Classical are passionate about music education, and none more so than classical host James Stewart. In his program called Timeline, James introduces us to events, characters, and concepts that shaped Western music. But lest you think Timeline is all about Bach and Chopin, today we make a leap from Europe straight into the heart of American music. Here's James Stewart with a brief lesson on the origins of blues, ragtime, and jazz.
Oh, freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Freedom.
In 1865, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified, abolishing slavery in the United States forever. As a result, an entire population of citizens was now free to pursue their education and their artistic dreams. The next generation saw the development of new musical styles, the American art forms of blues, ragtime, and jazz.
Well, it's too late to cry, baby.
The blues came from the American South in the late 1800s. It blends together the work songs, spirituals, chants, and ballads of the African-American community. Besides the obvious expression of sadness and melancholy, the blues also introduced stylized scales, chords, and unique forms. Blue notes are often seen as flattened thirds, or sometimes even pitches between notes, blurring the rules of traditional harmony. The form of the 12-bar blues has become ubiquitous in popular music around the world. Ragtime was born in the African-American communities of St. Louis in the 1890s. This style takes traditional form, much like the music of John Philip Sousa, and adds the syncopated or ragged rhythms of African music. The style fell out of favor in the early 20th century with the rise of jazz, but many compare the American rag to European minuets, mazurkas, and waltzes. The rhythm of ragtime had an influence on later composers such as Satie, Debussy, and Stravinsky. The word jazz means pep or energy. This style was born in the taverns of New Orleans at much the same time and with the same influences as blues and ragtime. But jazz had an added element of Cuban-Spanish culture. Habanero rhythms, blues forms, and ragtime drive blended together to form something new. Eventually, the rigid rhythms of the beat relaxed to allow a feeling we call swing. Swing is hard to define and difficult to notate. As Louis Armstrong stated, if you don't feel it, you'll never know it. The prohibition of the 1920s saw the rise of the jazz age in the U.S., cementing this style and sound into American culture. American orchestras and conservatories were slow to recognize these styles, but their European counterparts embraced them openly. Maurice Ravel saw in American jazz a fresh expression of harmony and rhythm that he borrowed in a great deal of his later works. Find out more about the development of blues, ragtime, and jazz, and follow the timeline at vpr.net/classical.
Timeline is produced by VPR's James Stewart, and it's made possible in part by a grant from the Ida and William Rosenthal Foundation. Subscribe to the Timeline podcast. It is fabulous. And speaking of podcasts, you can keep Vermont Edition in your pocket and never miss an episode. Subscribe in iTunes or wherever you access your favorite audio downloads. And that's Vermont Edition for today. Our program is produced by Sam Gale Rosen and Meg Malone. Our directors are Mary Williams and Liam Connors. And our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.